Hello, guys, and welcome back to the Roots Way podcast. I'm your host, Jason Ringenberg. Today we have Alonzo Rodriguez. He's a professional highliner, professional stoke haver, a rock climber, a tree net weaver, and an all-around amazing human. He has so many cool adventures to watch, and I've really enjoyed being his friend and seeing all of his adventures. So, without further ado, here is Alonzo Rodriguez. Hope you guys enjoy.
What's up, Alonzo? How's it going?
Yo, what's up, Jason? It's going well. How are you?
Oh, so good. Can you give the listeners a little introduction of who you are and what you do?
Totally. Yeah. My name's Alonzo. I'm a highliner, climber, tree net weaver, engineer, but I just like to have fun. I like to be outside as much as possible, even though I'm currently working the traditional corporate 9-to-5 office job. And that's pretty much it.
So how did you get into highlining and climbing and all the cool things you do?
Yeah. So back in 2017, it was my second year of college, and I used to be a really competitive soccer player back in high school, and I thought I was going to take that into college, but a couple of things happened, such as life, right? I got injured, wasn't able to keep playing, sports kind of faded for me, and I've always been someone that likes to move and be active, so losing that was a little hard, and I had to find something to kind of fill that void. And I actually was bodybuilding for a few years. I know I don't look it now, but back in 2017, I weighed 200 pounds and was the same body fat that I am now. And I don't know, I just, after a couple of years of bodybuilding and how monotonous it was, it just became kind of boring to me. And I knew it was time to find something else. And a good friend of mine, his name's Polly, he actually suggested we go hiking in Yosemite one weekend. And I'd never been hiking. You know, I'd never really been outside. I wasn't outdoorsy as a kid or anything like that other than playing soccer on the weekends and stuff. But we ended up going to REI to find some kind of water pack so we could have enough water to drink on this hike. And I actually ran into a route setter for our local climbing gym there. And, you know, this guy was super vascular, super strong looking. He just caught my eye, you know, as a bodybuilder, to see someone just super vascularly veiny and strong like that. It's always oh, man, what do you do as a workout, you know? And he's I'm a rock climber. We have a local gym in town. You should come check it out sometime. You know, hit me up. My name's Travis and this and that. He's actually a really good friend now, but we took him up on it. We went to the local climbing gym, and it literally took one day, and my friend and I were hooked. We joined that same day, and then just kind of through the trials and tribulations, you know, there was a little slackline set up in the gym, just how we got into slacklining. You know, we met a highliner in the gym, and he took us highlining one time, and just kind of the basic flow of, I feel how a lot of people get into it. You know, they join a rock climbing gym by accident, stumble upon a slack line, and next thing you know, you're dangling thousands of feet in the air somehow.
Yeah, so could you give some context of what highlining is?
Yes, so highlining is where you string a line, it's a piece of webbing, a 1-inch wide piece of webbing from point A to point B, usually really, really high, sometimes thousands of feet off the ground. And we walk across it, kind of like a tightrope, but rather than it being a steel cable, it's a 1-inch piece of nylon or polyester webbing, and that's really the only difference. Highlining is a lot cooler, in my opinion, than tightrope walking, because you can get real creative with the materials you're using, and you can make lines really, really bouncy. You can make them really, really surfy, so you can do things on them. And they're just a lot more fun.
Yeah, I mean, that in itself is a crazy thing to think about, right? Walking a 1-inch piece of webbing over a huge like expanse, like, and I've had the experience of watching you walk some of the craziest ones I've ever seen in person. How did you work up to that, and how did you get the courage to be able to walk that little line that's really loose and really like squirrely?
Yeah. Man, so I mean, aside from like the physical challenges that come with it, right? Because for the physical challenges, you know, you can go train in the park where you set a line not as high off the ground, and maybe you're only a couple feet off the ground, so you can train without the fear of being so high off the ground. It's actually more dangerous to slackline in the park because you can actually like hit the ground and like break your bones and stuff, just like kind of how bouldering is to roped climbing. But we'll get into that in a sec. The mental obstacles to actually standing up and walking on a highline were tough. I was highlining every weekend, and I don't think I got a successful stand for like the first like 4 months that I was actually trying to highline. It just took a lot of repetition and convincing my brain that I was okay and safe before I finally got a little bit comfortable with it. And at some point, after just doing it over and over and over, you know, basically failing over and over and over, something just clicks, and then you're able to really progress from that point.
Yeah, I think I'm in the like beginning stages of that. I was lucky enough to be on some highlands with some really, really cool people. And yeah, I mean, just the getting able to stand up thing is a whole thing in itself. And then like, as soon as you stand up and then fall, you then have to like climb the leash back up and then like reset yourself. And by the time you reset yourself, you're like already going to fall again. It's like so defeating. But yeah,
it is definitely very physical and mental. One of the things that is really interesting about highlining in comparison to a lot of other sports is the curve, the learning curve, right? Where like most sports, you can kind of ease into that learning curve, right? Like, you know, if you're learning to ride a bike, you put some training wheels on and, you know, you're basically unable to fall at that point. If you're wanting to rock climb, you start climbing like 5'4"s in the gym, and it's like a ladder basically, or, you know, any other sport basically. There's like a very beginner way to do it, right? But with highlining, is just, you just get thrown into the pit, you know, and you're like up high and like, you know, 1 inch is still 1 inch, and it's a really, really steep learning curve for highlining. And I think that kind of weeds out a lot of people, but you know, you just got to stick to it, wait for the click, and then bang, you fall in love.
Yeah, I'm still in the like trying to stand up part. And you know, I'm a pretty good rock climber. Like I've done the things, and I like have experience with being up high, but there's something about like not having anything to grab onto and like only the 1-inch piece of webbing that's like the only like grasp you have of like the ground at all, or like anything at all to like touch. It's like, that's such a wild thing to like think of and a wild thing to overcome. It just boggles my mind. Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, so, but you're also like a really good rock climber, right?
Yeah, I've been, I started with rock climbing before I got into highlining. And I think I climbed pretty consistently in a gym for a year before I even, you know, touched highlining. But then I got so into highlining that for 3 years, from like 2020 through 2023, I didn't touch a rock ever. I was just highlining. But the past 2 years, I've actually tried to challenge myself again, and I've actually inverse now. So I haven't really been touching slack lines very much in these past 2 years, and I've been almost exclusively rock climbing now.
Yeah, you just did the Northwest Face of Half Dome, didn't you?
You did, yeah, about What it's end of November. That's 2 months ago.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that experience? That's like one of the things that's been on my bucket list for a long time. I've climbed El Cap and almost everything else besides like walk-ins. But yeah, and the Northwest Face of Half Dome. Yeah, walk me through like that experience and like what that felt like, and yeah.
Yeah, totally. First of all, the Northwest Face of Half Dome, most of the free climbing you would do on that pitch goes at like 5:10. There's some, like the first seven pitches or so are like 5:10 and below. And then you got a couple of pitches of bolt ladders. And for those people that don't know, like there's climbing grades, and like 5:10 is like a pretty intermediate grade. It's not like elite, it's not like super advanced. It's like still in like the intermediate ranges and like very attainable for someone that puts their mind to it for like a couple of years and works toward it. So all the hard pitches are up at the top, like, and there's only like four of them, and you don't even have to free climb them. They're 5:12 pitches, but the cracks are so good that you can just stick protection in the cracks and pull on the protection. What's known as French free climbing or aid climbing, if you want to do that. So the climbing itself wasn't that intimidating. What was intimidating was trying to get from the ground to the summit in under a day, daylight, right? Because it's 23 spans of rope all the way to the top. So 23 pitches, as they call them. And I'd never done anything that big. The only thing that I've done before attempting Half Dome that was remotely that size was the Sthek Salathe, which is a different rock formation in Yosemite. And that one, for reference, is 16 pitches. And the hardest pitch on that one goes at like 5:10 minus, which is easier than pretty much anything on Half Dome. And what happened on my experience there was we were climbing so slow that we ended up pretty much shivering and freezing the entire night on the summit of the Sentinel, and it was awful. So I had a lot of nerves going into Half Dome that I was gonna have some kind of repeat and end up like shivering on a makeshift bivy on the wall. But luckily, little spoiler, that didn't happen. All the training I've been putting in these past years has paid off. But yeah, man, it was scary. So you start up by going up these things called the death slabs. And I mean, if the name death slabs doesn't instantly like cause your butt to pucker a little bit, then something's wrong with you. But it's just what it sounds like, right? Like the approach to the base is like a 3 hour hike with several thousand feet of elevation up some slabs. There's some fixed ropes on some of the steeper sections of the slabs, so you can just kind of like hand over hand it. But the slabs are so polished, and you're carrying a really heavy backpack up there, that it's really scary, especially when you read articles about some of those fixed ropes sometimes snapping and people falling down the death slabs. That was probably the spookiest experience of the whole adventure, right? But we actually did this in the course of 3 days. So day one, we just took to go up the death slabs and relax at the base, kind of replenish and like drink a bunch of water. We carried like 3 gallons of water each, almost. Maybe it was like 2.5 gallons, but we weren't sure if the little spring at the base of the rock would be running. So we carried a ton of water up there, and it was awful. But we got that done. And then on day two, we woke up at 4 in the morning to start climbing because, like I said, we didn't want to get benighted and end up having to shiver bivy on the wall. And it actually went really, really well. We ended up finishing in 12 hours, and everything went well up until the last like four pitches. My forearm started cramping a little bit, but beside that, it was pretty flawless. And we got to the top, came back down to the base, bivvied one more night, and then the next morning we went back down the death slabs, and that was that. Super successful. I wish I could tell about more like aggravating things that we went through, but it was surprisingly really smooth.
Yeah, the one thing I get worried about that particular route is the rockfall. Did you experience any like weird like rockfall phenomenon, or like seeing anything that might peel off the wall?
We didn't experience any rockfall or anything like super crazy loose while we were on the route. There was a party ahead of us that dropped one of their quick draws, and it hit me in the head. Luckily I was wearing a helmet, and it bounced off my head, and then I caught it midair. It was kind of cool. I gave it back to him. It was a French party, but yeah, the only thing that was falling was metal. No rock on this particular case.
Interesting. Also, so everybody that's listening, if you've been to Yosemite Valley, Half Dome is like one of the main attractions, right? There's like El Capitan, and then there's Half Dome, and Half Dome is probably the more recognizable one. And what Alonzo did is he went up the very big face of it. And so one question I have is, when you got to the top, did people recognize that you climbed the entire face? Because like there's always tourists up there, right?
Totally, yeah. And you know, some tourists are very well aware of like the fact that people climb those faces, and like, you know, some tourists were like, wow, you know, how long did it take you? And others were like, you know, they were kind of like, you could see in their faces when it starts to click the fact that you climbed up the vertical face rather than the cables, which is where all the tourists go up. And then they like, you know, instantly like their eyes widen and they go like, wait, you climbed on this side? And it's just like, you could see the like mind blown expression on their face. It's really cute and a little funny actually.
Yeah. I mean, so I've never climbed Half Dome, mostly because I want to go up the Northwest face first. You know, I've like had several, like more than several, opportunities to go up the Northwest face, or to go up like Snake Dyke or the cables or something, and I just like rejected that totally. I was like, no, I'm not going to go up there until I actually climb the face. So
really,
what did it feel like when you topped out the Northwest face of Half Dome? Were you like so psyched, like life goal achieved? Like, what did it feel like?
I think the psych came even before topping out all the way on the top. Pitch 20, or maybe pitch 21 or 20, is called the Thank God Ledge, and it's just basically this like real thin ledge that you can pretty much like walk across the whole way. And that's kind of when like you start to feel like super stoked, because you can like see the rim from that point, and you're like, wow, I can see the tourists from here, like we're so close, just three more pitches. I think I like lived down all the excitement during that point, because when I got to the top, I was stoked, right? But like, I think I had just like exhausted all my stoke on that pitch because of how epic it was and how close we were. And I looked at the time and we were only like 11 hours in, and it was just crazy. But yes, I was super stoked.
Yeah. So that's such a famous pitch. And also, anybody that's listening, like Google Alex Honnold's free solo. You'll probably see him like standing against the Thank God ledge, like totally free solo. It's a famous photo and a famous pitch in itself. Did you like crawl, or did you walk across it?
So you can walk about halfway across it. And then after that, the wall behind you, like the wall that you're standing against, kind of starts to overhang a little bit too much, and the ledge also gets thinner. So it actually, I mean, you probably could if you had really good balance, but it'd be really hard to walk the whole thing. So I walked up to the point where it was feasible, and then I like got down and like put my hands on the ledge, and then just kind of like traversed across. So halfway walked, halfway crawled kind of thing.
Yeah, so I think it's the next pitch that Alex talks about where he almost fell. It's like slabby or something.
Totally.
Could you give a little more context to like what that actually felt like?
Yeah, so that pitch, if my memory serves me, goes at like 512D, which is like super hard, right? Like I'm not climbing 512D, I'm climbing 510. Basically it's like smooth slab with tiny little lips like far and wide for hooking moves. And for anyone that doesn't know, like for aid climbing, we carry these tiny little hooks. Like they're like sometimes just millimeters thick, and you put them on tiny edges, and you can clip a ladder to that, and then you can stand on that ladder to make your next move. Even the aid climbing on that pitch was tricky and hard. I couldn't imagine trying to free climb something like that. Like especially free solo, you know, my buddy tried to top rope free climb it after I had let it, and even he, who was a 512 climber, said, "That's ridiculous. I cannot believe that Alex Honnold was up here without a rope. It's terrifying."
Yeah, it's so like mind blowing. Like I think Tommy Caldwell said, like everybody that knows what he's actually doing up there is terrified. And like I can attest, like, man, the mastery it must take to like even like have the balls to even try that is wild. Yeah. So going back to highlining, you've done a lot of highlining in Yosemite. Do you want to talk about like your favorite lines and like the one thing I do honor and like love you guys about in the highlining community is like your effort to like go through it all and like set up these lines. Can you like talk through like one of your favorite lines or I mean there's a half stone line as well, I think you did maybe, but yeah, anyway.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, like highlining in Yosemite, that's where it began, off the Lost Arrow Spire. So just because of the classicness of it all, those are probably my favorite lines, the ones that connect off of the tip of the Lost Arrow Spire. They're pretty short. There's three of them. There's a 20-meter one, a 30-meter one, and then a 50-meter one. But they're just so classic and so exposed that it's just hard to not be up there with a huge smile on your face, knowing, damn, this is where it all began. Like, these guys had some serious balls back then to have taken a sport that didn't exist and just take some like climbing carabiners and like some climbing webbing and be like, you know, we're gonna invent a new sport. Let's go walk on a piece of webbing like way up there, and like even though we don't really know what we're doing, it's crazy.
Yeah, and we've both climbed the Lost Arrow Spire. You actually dropped a rope for us when we did the Lost Arrow Direct. Yeah, like that like is so intimidating. Like just to be up there at all is intimidating. You got like Yosemite Falls like raging right next to you. And like I mean, I think the easiest one you have to like wrap into to like walk on it. But man, yeah, Dean Potter is such a visionary for doing that. Man, do you want to speak a little bit about like the origins of highlining in Yosemite and like Dean Potter, like, you know, what they did to like establish that and like what inspired you to be able to go up there and repeat the things that you were so
Oh
inspired for?
yeah. So Dean Potter, obviously, like he's got the like face of highlining because he did all these like crazy free solos before highlining was even a thing, really. But even before Dean Potter, I'm blanking on the name. I believe the name was Scott Balcom, though. A guy named Scott Balcom and his buddies were actually the ones that like did a lot of the FAs out there, including the Lost Arrow Spire. They were the first ones to walk those lines. Dean Potter would just come up and like free solo them, which is insane. Also, Dean Potter was he's doing a weird variation. Like he's not really highlining. He was kind of doing more so like tightrope walking because rather than walking a 1-inch piece of webbing, which is like the conventional highline material, he was walking a piece of Dyneema M steel, which is round and is basically like a fabric cable in a sense. And, you know, he had like a winch to tighten it and had it super tight, like a basically like a steel cable, you know. So he even invented like his own variation of highlining, which is like somewhere between tight roping and somewhere between highlining. I don't know, it's kind of weird. I've never tried walking on a piece of am steel, but it seems tough.
That seems way harder to me.
It seems way harder to me too. That's why I've never tried it.
Yeah, I mean, like I do like a little bit of give in the like slack of it because it's like easier to correct, you know. If it's like super super rigid tight, I feel like I'm just going to fall off it immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. And for anyone that wants to know what that feels like or get a glimpse, like go walk on a handrail somewhere.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and like the slack line, like at least gives you a little bit of like give. Like you can correct your motion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's like a common misconception, I think, because like a lot of people are like, I want it to be really tight. And then I'm like, well, with my experience, I don't want it to be tight. I want it to be like loose so that I can manipulate it a little bit. Yeah. So like, give me like your experience when you first stepped on the Lost Arrow Highline.
Man, yeah, that was joy. Especially because the time that I first stepped on the Lost Arrow Highline, we had actually done a pretty significant thing for the community. My friend Ryan Jenks had invited me out. It was June of 2020. I remember this. And he was doing a big rebolting mission on top of the Lost Arrow Spire because all of the bolts that existed up there at the time were like really old, really, really quite sketchy, to be honest with you. It was just like a mess up there. Like there was no kind of organization and bolts were just kind of scattered and they were extremely old and like the wrong material. So they were corroded and like it was bad. So we go up there. And we spend 2 days just like hand drilling a bunch of holes, which if nobody's ever hand drilled a bolt, you should go try it. It sucks. It's hard. And we hand drilled a bunch of holes and half inch holes too, which is harder than the conventional 3/8. But we did all that. And then, you know, after we finished doing all our work, we rigged all the lines and, you know, just knowing that like, man, I just did this thing for the community, and not just the Highline community, but the climbers as well, because we installed new wrap chains up there and stuff. It just felt like we had done something really good, and that really added to the stoke of being up there. So I was pretty elated when I first walked the Lost Arrow Spire. I think anyone in my shoes would have been.
Yeah, so I've done the Lost Arrow 3 times, I think. The first time I got up there and I was like, yeah, this is like a bunch of nonsense. There's just like bolts everywhere. They don't make sense. Which one is like the right one to use? It's just like a mank of chaos with like chains and stuff. Like, I don't know. And then mm-hmm. when I saw that you guys went up there and changed all of them to like be really cohesive and you put in like really good bolts, I was like, yeah, that's what it needed. I think there was a little like controversy from like removing Dean's old bolts, but like whatever, dude. Like I loved making it more safe. And like I said, I've climbed it 2 times since Ryan put in those. And man, it's way better. It's way cleaner, like way more cohesive. Good work.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's a funny topic too. Like the whole like changing like old routes and stuff, like, oh man, that's like a whole nother rabbit hole that you can go down as to whether it's like ethically correct to like modify routes to make them safer and all this and all that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big thing, and I think it's talked about a lot in the climbing space right now.
It is, and it's like politics. Like you definitely have like a divide, like, you know, some people are super against it while other people are for it. And It's interesting. I like to sit back and kind of see where people are at on that.
Well, I mean, like for context, I started climbing like 10 years ago. And when I started climbing, I didn't know anybody else that climbed. You know, I met like one person in a wilderness class that like knew what rock climbing was. And since like with like Free Solo and these climbing gyms popping up everywhere, like it's just a different sport than it was back then. And I think there may need to be some adjustments here and there to accommodate for that like bigger user group coming in, right? And so I think replacing anchors, at least replacing anchors and making sure that they are solid enough that they can withstand all the new user groups coming in, right? I mean, that's my opinion.
Totally,
Yeah. So you climbed the Lost Aerospire Direct. How was that?
that was actually super fun. Oh man, I brought my buddy Skyler up that wall, and he had never done a big climb before this one. We were originally going to do it in a party of three with my partner, with my girlfriend. And she actually bailed the night of because, she just didn't want to be having a bad time and, party of three. She just got into this like weird headspace. So we ended up going the two of us. And let me just say, like, he was bummed. He was so bummed. You know what it was like your first time on a big wall when you're not actually free climbing very much and you're just hanging in your harness for a bunch of pitches, and your feet hurt, and the climbing's going really slow. Like it takes a couple hours to climb pitches versus like 20 minutes, He was just, by the time we got to that pitch with the tree belay, which is an awful haul, by the way, on that pitch, that one was terrible. He was really bummed by that point. That was we ended our first day at the top of that tower on pitch eight, and we pretty much like got up there at like 10 p.m. We started climbing at like 8 a.m. that morning, and he was just like, I could see in his face that he was not having a good time, and he's like, I want to go down in the morning because this is not fun. And we had actually agreed that we were going to go down in the morning because, he's having such a shit time. But when we woke up in the morning and we slept in, we didn't wake up till like 9 a.m. It was nice. We had replenished our stoke a little bit, and we had some friends on the summit who had rigged a highline. And then we like did the math. We were like, okay, if we like rappel, managing a haul bag and then having to do that descent down those like kind of like fourth class slabby like grassy things, it's going to take us X amount of hours. But if we go up, we only have like four pitches to go up, and like all these pitches are like relatively straightforward, and then we just have to hike down the trail and we can get water up there and this and that. We ultimately ended up deciding that it was like the same amount of effort to go down at this point than it was to go up. So I was able to convince him to keep going up, and we actually ended up topping out. But yeah, it was great for me. I had a great time, like when you have the nice thick big wall harness and it's supporting your lower back properly, it's great. But my buddy did not have any of the right equipment, so he had a rough time.
Dude, I think it's crazy to try to go back down that approach, like without big haul bag. Like that just spells you're gonna die to me. And that you touch on a point where it's like sometimes you're so committed to a project, and like you're already like halfway through climbing a big wall, and you're like it's just easier to go up, like bail up, I think is the term. Yeah, dude, like when me and my buddy Matt did it, we relied on a stream to get water from. And we had contacted like local Yosemite people, and they were like, yeah, it should still be running. It was not running. And so This was about the time that Matt contacted you to bring us a rope to like drop down into the like notch of the Lost Arrow Spire. And I wrapped in to the bottom of Yosemite Falls, like the big one, to get water. And like as soon as I was wrapping back up, I saw somebody like rappelling into like next to Yosemite Falls. And then I was like, what? Who's that guy? And then like I got the water, hauled it back up, and then got to Matt. And we were both like, who is this guy? Like, what is he doing? And then it was you.
Yeah, I literally just did that to get a cool photo. Like, I already had the rope up there, and I'm like, ah, whatever. I'm going to, like, rappel down near the falls, because why not?
Yeah, just for context.
That's funny.
So anybody that's been to Yosemite, the really big waterfall, the biggest waterfall in the United States, probably, I think. I was simultaneously, like, at the bottom with a rain jacket, like, suffering super hard trying to fill water bottles, and at the same time Alonzo is like rappelling down right next to the biggest waterfall in the United States, and I'm like looking up at him like, what is going on?
Yeah, that's it's a long distance too. It's like 1,000 feet away. Like, for anyone listening, I didn't know that Jason was down there watching me like do that. I had no idea.
I was at the bottom of the waterfall, like literally like gonna die if I made any like mistake and just like filtering or like, well, yeah, I guess I was filtering, but like getting enough water so that we could climb the Lost Arrow direct and like haul it back up. Yeah, that was so funny. I was like, oh, that's actually like my buddy that's doing that. That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, it's such a cool thing about the like highlining and climbing communities too. Like, especially the highlining community, like a lot of the time, because the community is still so small, anytime you see somebody walking highline, 7 times out of 10, if you walk up there and like find out who those people are, they're your friends.
Yeah.
Like you already know who they are.
Yeah, you're like, oh, yep, that's him up there.
Yeah, even from like 1,000 feet away, I kid you not, like some of my closer friends who I've been highlining with a lot now, I can tell just because of the way they walk. Like everyone's got their very own unique style. And even from a really long distance away, you can tell like, oh, like, yep, that's Jose, or oh, yep, that's Skylar, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's such a bold sport. Like, it's just so ridiculous. It's so ridiculous in every single way, but like after a minute it feels like kind of normal, and that to me is insane. You know, have you ever thought about like, getting into base jumping?
So I have actually. At the same time that I was like getting super into highlining, I was doing a bunch of skydiving. I got my A license, and I've jumped like 50 times out of an airplane at this point in my life. And the only reason I didn't, we can talk about this later too, but I'm trying to like semi-retire. So I've been saving money and like trying to quit my job in the next 3 months, you know? And one of the things that was hindering that was skydiving, because it's so freaking expensive. Mm-hmm. So I think the only reason that I'm not base jumping today is because skydiving was too expensive and the barrier to entry was a lot.
Yeah, I feel that. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like a logical way to get down. And like, you know, we talked about Dean Potter, and, you know, we have mutual friends that do that all the time. So, I mean, it is like a logical next step, because it unlocks like another like whole thing in the spectrum. But also you do a lot of rope jumping. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, I love rope jumping. So rope jumping is like you basically, like, in the simplest terms, you rig a high line, you attach climbing ropes to the middle of it, and you tie into the end of the climbing rope. Sometimes the ropes are really long. Like, sometimes we're tying multiple ropes together to get a longer jump. And we basically are, like, essentially rigging our own bungee jumps off high lines. And, like, we jump off cliffs and fall for 2 to 3 to, what was the Dana one, like 600 feet or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so anywhere between, like, 100 to 600 feet of free fall, just down into the abyss. It's awesome. It's like being in an amusement park, but you rig the ride yourself.
Yeah, so I think that's the first time I met you officially, actually, is I jugged up all the way up Leaning Tower, and you and Ryan had already, like, established the high line, and I was, like, on the team to, like, make that stuff happen. Do you want to talk about, like, the significance of that jump? Especially yeah. Because I'm from Tahoe. I know mm-hmm. people that are related to Dano. I know lots of people that knew him. Yeah, it's a very, like, significant event. So yeah, if you want to give a little context about that, that'd be sweet.
100%. Yeah. So Dan Osman was this legendary climber. And the guy was crazy, but, like, in the coolest ways. He was like a free soloer, and he pretty much invented rope jumping in Yosemite too. Kind of how it started for him, like, he was just, like, taking these huge whips, but on purpose. He just, like, liked the feeling of falling, I guess, you know, while attached to the end of his rope. So he invents rope jumping in Yosemite, where he essentially did the exact same thing, but rather than rig his rope jumps on high lines, he was just doing them on more ropes, because highlining hadn't been invented yet. And he was doing some of the world's biggest rope jumps as well in this park, and one of them, which I think at the time that he did it, was the world's biggest for a bit. He jumped it, and he jumped off Leaning Tower and basically, like, jumped all the way down to the tree line. We were like, he claimed that he had to, like, avoid the trees as he was, like, swinging down, which is insane. I can't even imagine that. Anyway, he does that. And then, you know, he goes back up to de-rig the rope jumps. Or the rope jump, sorry. And once he was up there, ready to de-rig, he decides, oh, you know what? I'm going to jump one more time. And that jump was his last, because he died on that jump. And so it was really significant, because it was huge, first of all, and nobody had dared to go and recreate that stunt until a couple years ago, when Ryan Jenks had the idea. And yeah, and I was, I was honored that he invited me to that, and that we got to do that, because it was crazy.
Yeah, I was honored that I got invited on that thing as well. I mean, like, you know, I was born in Tahoe, right? So I knew about Dano for so long, and like, I love Ryan for, like, getting the balls to, like, recreate that. And I mean, it's such a significant jump in climbing history, right? You did a backflip off of it. How did that feel like?
You know, the backflip itself didn't feel too crazy, because I had done a number of rope jumps at this point, and I've done a lot of backflips off cliffs. But just that jump itself was so terrifying, because it was like 2.5 times as big as the biggest thing I'd ever jumped. So it was gnarly. Like, normally I do my backflip, and I rotate them pretty slow, so that by the time I'm, like, you know, I've got it pretty dialed, so that, like, on a 70 meter jump, by the time I'm done with my backflip, I'm hitting the bottom of the swing, where, like, you feel the ropes engage, and, like, you stop falling and you start swinging. Well, I did 2 backflips on this one, and even after the second backflip, I was still falling. And It was scary. It was easily, without a doubt, like the scariest moment of my life was jumping off that cliff.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wanted nothing to do with that. I was like watching you guys do it, and I was like, nope, I'll film, I'll haul you guys back up. Yeah, that's another thing. Like, the hauling system we use to get people back to the cliff, like, that in itself was amazing. And like, you had to go out and reset it. Do you want to like explain a little bit about how you did that?
Yeah, so basically, like, so the way it works is, like, you're jumping on ropes that are attached to the high line, and the only way to get somebody off is to haul them back up with a totally separate rope, but they can't jump with that rope attached to them, because if they were to do that, that would throw a whole nother, like, variable of a rope into the system, and if anything got snagged or crossed or like anything in any way, like you're falling at like terminal velocity basically, right? So if those ropes cross or something gets abraded, you're dying. They're, one rope's gonna cut the other one, and that's it, you're done. I mean, there is a lot of redundancy in the system, so maybe I'm being dramatic, but it wouldn't be good. So we have to engineer a way to get the ropes in and out of the system, right? And it's a really complex topic. If you want to learn more about it, you can look up like rope jumping systems and stuff. But in a nutshell, right, there's a big ring that goes around the ropes that we jump on, and that ring is able to travel all the way from the high line to down to the person that just jumped. And so to reset the system, you have this like giant like clothesline basically that goes from that jump point on the high line out to the cliff. And it's like, how you get your clothes off a clothesline, you have to like roll the pulleys, and like you can like pull the clothes into your house so you don't have to go outside, kind of thing, right? It's basically like that, but on like an industrial level for rope swinging, to reset this rope and allow it to travel up and down and get it out of the way so that people can jump. And then after someone's jumped, you get it back in the way so that it goes down to the person, and then they just clip themselves to it. And it's just one really long rope that runs straight up to the cliff. We put it on a progress capture, like a micro traction or a pro traction or something, and it's literally just human powered at that point. Like everyone grabs hold of the tail and yanks them back up, and it's great. It's like an elevator ride all the way back up. It was really cool because I we were, I'm like 150 meters down from the top of the cliff. And as I was coming back up, I was passing like all the climbing parties that were climbing Leaning Tower, and like having like a legit conversation with them. It was hilarious.
That's so silly.
Like the highest form of luxury right there.
Like, okay, guys, bye. Oh man, yeah. I mean, and it's like it took an army to like create that sort of thing, and I loved being a part of it. There was like four or five people just like hauling the jumper up like super quickly, or like as
I think
quickly as
I think
possible.
we had more than that. I think we had at least I think we had closer to 10 people probably.
That's so wild. It takes an army to do these
It
like
does, yeah.
crazy things.
It
And like
does, it really does.
the coolest part was like nobody got hurt. It was totally, and like Jinx had like a dynamometer, whatever, like the thing that
That
makes the
dynamometer, yeah,
yeah.
or a load cell.
Yeah. So he was like measuring like all the loads. And he knew exactly what everything could take, and it was so professional and like so rad. Like that project was amazing. It's so funny, like just these like passion projects that we can do now because we have the technology. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you also weave space nets or nets as they're called. I think maybe, I don't know, was it Andy that did the first one? I don't know. But yeah, anyway, what are nets like, and what are their applications, and how do you weave them?
Yeah, so I weave tree nets. Space nets is like a variation of a tree net, but basically what it is like it's a tree house made completely out of cord, like ropes and paracord and stuff. So they create this like really dynamic system of like bungees that like it's like a platform made out of bungees that you can jump up and down on, and it's got walls and like if your trees are big enough, you can like create multiple levels and like portals that go into like different places and stuff. They're super rad. I've been doing it as a little side business now for the better part of a year, and I have an absolute blast doing them. They're amazing. Basically, it's a perimeter of like something really beefy, like static rope usually or amsteel, and then it's filled. You weave it really tightly with paracord, and you basically weave it to the point where every hole on the platform is small enough so that your foot won't slip through any of the holes. And they're super rad.
Yeah, I know. I've been on a couple of them. Yeah, I mean, I think the first time I went on one was I don't know if you know Ryan Redfoot. He's been on the podcast before, and Andy. They set up like their like space net, which had like a little spiral staircase like up to it. And I thought that was so cool. It's like a little like adult playground to like jump around on and like climb up, and yeah, it's super epic. And I really admire the like new designs that are coming out with like the staircases and like even like little slides and stuff, and it's just weaved out of paracord. It's like so awesome.
Yeah, it's a great use for paracord for sure.
Yeah, I mean, do you worry about like if the paracord is gonna break at all?
No, because so as you're weaving, you tie hitches every now and then, clove hitches usually, right? And basically every single clove hitch that you tie creates a redundant, independent point from one another, right? So think of it like you have this giant net woven with like thousands of strands of paracord, and each of those strands of paracord is independent from one another, right? So that means if I took a knife and I like cut a gash in the platform, it would still be like for the most part standing strong and super safe.
That's epic.
The
Yeah.
weakest point in any net structure are the anchors.
Okay.
So, like, if a tree came out of the ground, for example, yes, that would be a huge problem. But the net itself, no, that doesn't concern me typically.
Yeah, you've done some really fun stuff. Like you did one like over a river recently, and I thought that was sick. Like in a like there's like a river running below you, and like you can see it through all this like beautifully woven paracord. And man, that's so cool. I love it.
Yeah, I got a few projects lined up for the spring. But yeah, like I said, it's a small little side business I'm doing. So, Tree Net Weaves is my Instagram page for that. Tree Net being one word. So if anyone wants to check them out and book a tree net weaving job, let me know.
Also, what do you do for work that sustains your like lifestyle?
Yeah, so I'm actually an engineer. I've been working your pretty like regular 9 to 5 corporate office job now for the past 5 years. And I'm getting to the point in my life where I want a change of scenery. It's actually been really hard to keep this job this past year. I started dating somebody a year ago, and she works down in San Diego. And we live in like central California, so which is like a 4 hour drive away from one another. And she lives here, so she's having to commute and like do all this stuff. And the reason we're doing that is because the cost of living is a lot cheaper here than San Diego. But it's been really hard for her to do all that commuting. So I, I've been wanting to quit my job for a while now anyway, just to like get a change of scenery and fun. And this is kind of like a great excuse to do that. So that's what we're doing. Come early this year, like springtime, I will take a long sabbatical from my job that has been sustaining me now. But I've got savings and I've been like really good financially, so I'm not like leaving and like I'm totally screwed or whatever, you know?
So what are your plans? Like, what are you gonna do for your big long freedom? I like kind of just came off of that same thing. I did 6 months off of work, and I accomplished a lot of like cool stuff. Like, what do you think you're gonna be like with like free Alonzo stuff?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've always wanted to do is like a slow travel thing, because with a 9 to 5, you maybe get a week off, like on a good vacation, right? So it's like you're gone for a week, but it feels all pretty rushed because you're trying to cram in like as much fun things as possible because you have such a short period of vacation. So some of the plans we've got already like booked, set in stone kind of thing. Next May, we're going to Costa Rica for a friend's wedding, and we're just gonna spend some time out there and enjoy a new place. And then at the end of the year, we're actually gonna road trip down to Mexico over the span of like a month, month and a half, and just really enjoy new things and live life.
Sick, dude. That sounds so amazing. I would love to see what happens with Alonzo in his actual free time. I'm sure you're gonna come up with like so much stuff.
I feel like I do a lot already, and I've definitely had like worried friends and worried parents tell me like, you already get to do so much, like don't leave this job, this is a good job, and like blah blah blah, but that's the thing about being young, you gotta do this stuff while you can, because if you do like the traditional like work until you're 65 or whatever, your health and your youth is gone at that point. Like we gotta take a bunch of time off now while we're able to do things,
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge thing to be said about time is way more important than money, right? You can get money back, you can't get time back. So
Exactly. It's the most valuable thing we own is
it
our
is
time.
100%. Cool. We're about at an hour. Do you want to keep talking or are you, yeah. Do you need to
It's
do
up to
stuff
you.
or?
No, I got the evening free, man. Whatever you want to do.
Cool. So I'm gonna go to the bathroom right now, but then we can keep talking. But usually I book like an hour for folks if they like need to do something. But yeah, I'm willing to keep talking, but I'm gonna go to the bathroom. Also, like this section is gonna be cut out. So if you need to do
For sure.
something, go ahead.
Cool.
you?
Yep.
Cool. All right. Yeah, I'm like so interested to see like what you want to accomplish like more in your life, because you've already done like so many cool things and you're like always doing cool things. Is there like one really, really big goal that like you'd want to accomplish?
You know, one of the things that I would love to do is put up a big wall first descent, like, you know, where I take a really good friend, it would honestly probably be my girlfriend, and we carry a bunch of bags to the base of this wall that's never been climbed before, maybe in like a remote area somewhere, and you know, we put in the work to figure it out, aid climb it, free climb some pitches, but draw the topo, you know, and just spend like, who knows, maybe even up to a month on a portal edge, you know. I think that would be crazy. That'd be so fun.
Yeah, Kokomo Valley comes into mind there, or Baffin Island.
I have to check those places out.
Yeah, dude, Kokomo seems cool. It's like, it takes, I don't know, something like 5 days to get there, and it's basically Yosemite Valley. And there's like hand-drawn topos on like in like little like stash can things.
Oh, that's like, so funny.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I'm watching that Kokomo Valley, I think, but yeah, yeah. It's epic, and yeah, of course Baffin is always stuff like there. Also, like the Ruth Gorge, that might be a thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not even something I've like seriously looked into yet, but it's just an idea that I've had for a while now that I think would just be something to say, like, I've done this in my life, and I think that's really cool, you know?
Yeah, putting up new routes is like super fun.
You know? Yeah, I've done it a little bit. There's a local guy in our town here that has his own little area, and he it's cool. He keeps it off mountain projects, so he's got his own guidebook that he wrote, and he's like, you know, he's brought us out developing with him, and we've put up sport climbs on lead, and it's super cool just to like do that and like drill a bolt like while you're like leading a route. It's kind of a crazy experience, but super fun.
Yeah, I've done one, like I did a like 5.9 like one pitch route in the Zion National Park area. Yeah, that's fun. Like, it's cool because like you can drill in a little bit with a hammer drill, and then when you get it in enough, you can like clip a quick draw to it and like hang on it to rest. And then,
yeah, it's scary. It's so scary, but yeah, that goes.
Yeah, no, it's scary, but there is something to say about like the ground up ascent, right? Because like you can wrap bolt stuff, right? But like there's something to say about like, if I could hold this stance and also like have a hammer drill in my hand and like drill it and put the bolt in, like that's something to say about a good rest stance. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not even just like about the style, but it just like, you know, just like changing routes to make them safer. It was like a big ethics thing too back in the climbing community, like with John Backer and stuff. Like, I know there was a lot of controversy on a route in Joshua Tree that this guy was like trying to do. I think it went at like 5:13, and he was he couldn't figure out how to place a bolt on lead because it was such a hard sequence of moves. So he ended up placing like one or two of the bolts while on rappel, and Backer actually like came and chopped them, and he's like, "No, if you're gonna do this, you got to do it the right way. Like, we don't do that, you know."
Yeah, I mean, dude, like Backer had the best style, or like the purest style, I guess. Yeah, if we want to talk about like climbing ethics, man. So like the Backerian, man. Sorry, my dogs are coming in and out, but Yeah, so like the Bakugyarian, you know that story, right?
Yeah, that's insane. The Tuolumne routes, like that one, and then there's you asked for it. Bananas. It's like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so anybody that's listening, the Bakugyarian is probably maybe the most notorious route in Yosemite, or like a very famous one in Yosemite history. And it was funny because John Bakker didn't trust any of his belayers to actually belay him on this because it was way too wild. And so he ended up going to the Tuolumne store and recruiting just like some nobody he had ever met before. And was like, yeah, I'm working on this project, like, come belay me. And that guy, poor guy, did not know what John Bakker was about to do. Ended up just taking, like, John took, like, huge whips. And, like, this unsuspecting guy was like, what's happening? Oh, man. Crazy
guy. Yeah.
Yeah, and he put that all up on Camp Hooks, I think, right?
I believe so, yeah. Either that or Sky Hooks. I don't know which ones, but he was on Tiny Hook. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fucking a wild story.
That's insane. Like, not for me.
Yeah, I have several friends that are trying to repeat it, and I'm like, good luck. That's not a place I'm going to be at ever.
Yeah, I'm not one to like, I like to push my limits as far as like physically what can I do, but I never like to push the risk boundaries, you know, like if a route's like rated R, for example, or like, you know, like I'm also like not going to be taking my leash off to Highline or things like that. Like, I don't know. I just, there's two kinds of people. There's like the person that likes to safely push their limits and just see like how much their bodies can handle, and then there's the people that like to push the limits of their mind and like see how much safety they can get rid of and like how calm and good they can still climb without the safety. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, have you ever thought about free soloing in climbing?
I mean, I have a little bit, like very easy stuff, you know, like I've soloed Sunnyside Bench and like, you know, maybe like some random like other 5-6 or whatever, but like I would never free solo anything hard or like anything where like I even had a chance of falling, you know?
Yeah, for sure. But like the process of getting from like trad climbing to like simul climbing and like placing less and less protection all the time, and then leading up to like, well, I might as well have soloed this, and then it just leads you like kind of automatically to like, I'm just gonna solo it. Does that sound like something you've experienced? Because that's something I've definitely experienced.
I've gotten to the point where I've gotten to the level of like simul climbing and like placing very few protection pieces, but I just have never liked the idea of playing with the like possibility of death, you know, like I don't know, like you always hear these stories of like, oh, you know, talented free soloer, like, you know, and they usually they're dying on like 5-8s, you know, even though they're like 5-12 climbers and stuff. So it's just like, I don't know, like, it's just not something that I want to ever pursue, because you never really know, you know, like, every time I watch, like, Alex Honnold free soloing something, I'm like, man, like, what if his forearm cramped right now, like, what if, like, something just, like, by chance happened, and, like, his forearm cramped, or, like, I don't know, like, what if there was, like, a little bit of rock fall that hit him right in the head, and, like, concussed him, and, like, he lost his balance, you know, there's just like things that happen sometimes that I'm like, no.
Yeah. There is like this progression though, that you go from like, you know, top rope, right? Safe. Sport climbing. Okay. Like we're starting to get pretty safe. then you start like leading Spark climbs, and then you are comfortable with falling. Cool. Nice. Then you get comfortable with falling, and then you learn how trad gear works, and that scares you to hell. And you're like, okay, it's the same thing as Spark climbing, but like, it's kind of like, as long as I know how this works, good. Then you learn how that works. And then you start to be like way too comfortable with dread climbing and placing gear. And you're like, okay, now I just know the terrain so well. And I know how this gear works. And then you just start placing the gear like less and less often. And then you come to the realization that, well, maybe I don't. I mean, I only placed like one piece of gear like in 30 feet. I'm like confident enough. And then you start to be like, well, even if I didn't place that, like I'm still going to die. And then so that like that kind of like thing, that like mindset like keeps coming. And then eventually you're like, well, yeah. Like free solo makes sense. I know that's like a really weird and like hard concept to get, but that's the concept that I went through and that I think people that free solo go through.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I can see it, but I think at the same time, most of the people that do end up going through that, like kind of at least like maybe even subconsciously, like in the back of their minds, want to free solo, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like they just want to anyway.
Yeah, like they just want to anyway, and that's just like the progression you kind of have to take. Because I mean, like I see what you're saying, like you progress from top rope to spark climbing and then trad and stuff, but I think sport and trad climbing are like two totally separate things, you know, because the thing that drew me to trad climbing personally wasn't the fact that like, oh, this is like spicier than sport climbing, like I want to do this. It was just like how adventurous you could be with it, you know, like trad climbing allows you to go from like bottom to top of like some of the biggest walls in Yosemite, where like if you're limited to the sport climbing ability only, you're not going to get very high on most of these walls, you know, unless you're climbing in like Potrero Chico or something. So I see what you're saying, but I also think that people get into things for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, that is a super good point, and like probably the best point to make for trad climbing, because you can just take like, you know, like 12 cams or something like that and just climb anything in the world, and like you're not limited at all to like. Like, you can make anchors, you can, like, belay people up, you can rappel down with nuts or whatever. That, the freedom is probably the best part of trad climbing, for sure. And, like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, you're right, that's the best.
Yeah, it's great. I love how liberating trad climbing can be in the world of adventure sports. I mean, anything with a crack in it, if you're strong enough, you can just go up that thing safely.
Yeah, especially because you, like, if you have enough, like, camming equipment and, like, nuts and stuff that can fit into the crack you're climbing, you can essentially, like, put yourself on top rope the whole time, like, if you need to. And, like, you can rest and, like, do whatever you want. That's something that's way different than sport climbing, because sport climbing is set to a certain like parameter, essentially. Like you're sort of at like the whatever the guy that set it set, you know, like maybe he's too tall, maybe they're too short, maybe it doesn't work for you, you're like at their mercy. But like with trad climbing, that's not that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree.
Yeah, trad.
Yeah, trad.
Trad rad.
Yeah, trad is pretty rad.
Yeah, dude, I've like oftentimes people are like, what is all that stuff? And I'm like, oh, it's just the best thing in the world. You can climb anything in the world with all of this thing, like right in my truck bed.
Yeah,
Like,
it is really cool. Yeah, my parents are often, they'll always ask, they're like, "Oh, what'd you do this weekend?" It's like, "We went climbing," and they're just so shocked that like we just go climbing all the time. They're like, "Don't you get bored of like doing the same thing over and over and over again?" And it's like hard to explain how, especially with trad climbing, how different every adventure you go on is. Like, yes, you're doing the same thing. Like, you're throwing on your climbing shoes and you're like climbing a route, but they're all so unique and different in many different ways.
dude, you know what I like the most about it? Is it just accesses so many things that seem impossible. Like I hang out with a lot of thru hikers, and there's a lot of thru hikers on this podcast too. But like there's something to be said about like I know how to get over that thing over there, and it would be really fun. And it's just like a level of accessibility that's like it makes you feel like Superman kind of thing. Like I know I can climb that mountain, and I know I can get off of that mountain, and it's not going to be a thing, and it's not going to be very hard. It's just like the level of accessibility to the mountains and the level of accessibility to the views is like the biggest part for me.
Absolutely. We actually talk about that a lot in highlining, especially like when we rig a new line that nobody's ever walked before. We're always like, I guess the word would be like grateful and also like wowed that after this planet having been here for, millions of years and like people have been alive for who knows how long, right? That no human has ever been where I'm standing at this moment right now.
That is so fucking cool. Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it's about like just the crazy positions that you can like access because you're good at a certain thing and your friends are really good at a certain thing. And all together, you have decided that we can access this like crazy plane of existence that nobody's ever thought about, maybe, or ever experienced. And maybe you're the only person that's ever seen that perspective.
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
It's amazing to me, like
Mind blowing.
endlessly. Yeah. What, so going back to that point, what was like the one time that you really, really thought about that and experienced it? Like, and you were like, whoa. Can you describe it?
Yeah, it was probably the time we once rigged a line from the top of Mount Broderick to Liberty Cap. And it's that those rocks are both right off the most popular hiking trail in Yosemite. And I was standing on the line looking down at the trail, and everyone on the trail is just like a bunch of ants like walking on the trail, right? And like I think it was like right at that moment that it like really hit me that like I'm like, wow, like they're on a trail, and that how many footsteps have been on that trail? Millions, hundreds of millions probably. And yet like I'm in this place that's like so close to that heavily traveled area, and I'm the only person to have ever existed in this space. And it's just I don't know. It was one of those moments where, like, I just kind of like blew my mind by accident, just by like overthinking.
I don't think that's by accident at all. What he is trying to explain right now is he did something very, very hard and very, very hard to get to. And like nobody could even imagine doing it. I think you're like so underestimating or like unexplaining how hard it was to be in that space for normal humans. It's, oh, man, it's so hard to do. Do you want to like elaborate how you even got up there to do that? But also first, if anybody's been up the very, very famous like Mist Trail up to like the backside of Yosemite to what, Vernal Falls and Nevada Falls, you've seen it and you've looked up at it and been like, what, that's incredible. Yeah. Alonzo here has walked on top of that on a 1-inch Highline. That's like so incredible. It's mind blowing and one of the most incredible things that I've ever even heard of. So anyway, how did you even get up there? How did you rig it? How did you walk it? Go through it.
Yeah, so I mean it takes a village, you know, like highlining is definitely, I mean you can do it by yourself, but it's a lot easier if you've got a good sized team that all knows what they're doing to help you get the line from point A to point B, right? So one team had to climb one of the rocks all the way to the tippy top while the other team climbed the other one. And one of them is actually quite a bit higher than the other one. So we had to figure out a rappel route down the rock, you know, on the face that faced the other one. And we actually had to figure out anchors and all that stuff. So we, you know, we brought bolting kits and like, it was a whole operation, like lots of ropes, lots of metal, lots of webbing for us to walk on. Once we figure out nice level anchors and we have some kind of tagline across, we have to pull it across, all the way across. This was like a 300 meter span, so like the length of just above 3 football fields, basically. And that's considered small now, and like how far this sport has progressed. Like back in the day, just like 5 years ago or something, that would have been like a world record. And now that's like whatever. And yeah, you pull it across. And then with special equipment, you get attention to the level you want to. And then you still have to have the skill to be able to walk across it successfully.
I mean, it's really hard to describe with people that are listening now what actually that means. And I mean, that's incredible. How do you even like get the balls to like get up and walk that thing? And like, what are you doing in the middle of it? Like, are you listening to music? Are you like just zoned in like super, super far? Do you like fix on a point like way ahead of you to focus? Like, what is your method to like focus on walking that incredible thing with like so much distraction? Like, you're in Yosemite Valley, you're like way up, like in the most incredible space in the world. How do you even focus? It's incredible.
That's a good question. I think 90% of highliners listen to music while they're on the line. I'm one of them. I like music. It's just a good way to like zone out from the distractions. I think the biggest distraction per se in a national park is when like a tourist sees you and they freak out and they like scream. That's always kind of like off-putting. Like, you don't want to hear people screaming while you're trying to focus. So music just kind of drowns all that out. And, yeah, and then you just, you know, you start small. Like, you don't start walking on, like, lines that big. You start on really tiny ones, like, in the park where, you know, you just kind of pick a point on the tree and, like, you focus on it, like, really hard. And, like, that's your focal point, right? So everything is focused on that one point. But as you get to these bigger lines, because the anchor's so far away, it's impossible to, like, focus on something on the other side. So I actually just have like I just kind of like look at nothing, like kind of like only like 20 feet ahead of me. I just stare at whatever's 20 feet ahead of me, usually like right through the webbing and like down at the cliff, because I don't like to look at the webbing that's ahead of me, because sometimes the webbing way ahead of you, right, like hundreds of meters ahead of you might be doing like a wobbly thing, but in your brain, you're going to trick yourself into thinking that wobble is happening right under your feet, and you're going to try to correct for it, even though it's not happening at your feet, it's happening far away from you. So it's best on big lines to not look at the webbing and look at something else. So I look down, like I'm looking down at the hundreds of meters of emptiness below me and just kind of focusing on nothing while enjoying the music and taking the next step.
That is so wild to me. So like you're able to like keep this balance for so long, and like it doesn't even bother you if you look down.
I feel like I have to look down. I feel like if I look up, I'll lose my balance because I'm like now looking at what the webbing is doing and it's distracting.
Yeah, so I've learned that like with those big lines, it's actually like more stable. Because, yeah, you get those, like, little wobbles, but they don't actually, like, get to you. Yeah, I mean, also, I think you know Danny Schlitt.
Yeah.
He just set the world record. I went with I organized a trip in Jordan with him, and... Yeah, he like is so comfortable on the line. Like he can just like pee on it, like stand sideways, pee off, like, and then just like keep walking. Like that is incredible for like anybody that isn't normal human. Like you're literally like standing on a 1-inch webbing, like thousands of feet above like whatever. There's nothing to grab onto. It's and you're just like standing sideways and like going to the bathroom. That to me is just I have no idea how you guys get that like that boldness and that like comfortability on that.
Yeah, he's so funny. I actually saw him less than a week ago at GGBY, and I was talking to him about that experience a little bit. And yeah, they actually had a bit of a crazy experience because they, you know, they rigged this line that was like 3 kilometers long. And they had such a short weather window, and he was actually one of the only 2 people that was able to cross it before they had to take it down due to bad weather. Because, you know, if you have bad weather, like wind, that becomes exponentially dangerous to try to do. So it's best to just take your stuff down at that point.
Yeah, and he would have been, like, the only one that could cross it because he did, like, another one. Also a mutual friend, Nate Stevens, he's also on the podcast, like made a documentary about like Nate crossing or about, yeah, about like the crossing that he did there. Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna cut that out, sorry. But yeah, Danny is epic.
Yeah. Insane. I don't know how long we'll have the record for this time, because it's been hopping back and forth between the US and Europe. Like it's like the French, those guys are really good at highlining too, and they're always keeping us on our toes by like taking records back and stuff. But it's cool because like we're all like friends, and yeah, that's another great thing about the community. Like I went to France in 2019. I pretty much had a place to stay almost all the time just because I was in the Highline community, and I could like hop on this Facebook group full of Highliners, and they would be like, oh yeah, for sure, like come stay at my house, like you got a couch here whenever you want. And it was sick.
Yeah, that's epic. Yeah, no, dude, like the collaboration with the Highline community is like really admirable. Like everybody's just like getting all their webbing together and like prepping for epic projects. Yeah. Yeah, there's no like ego thing going on there, I don't think.
No, it's great. I encourage anyone that's interested in trying it to just try it. The easiest way to do it, go on Facebook, look up like a slackline group near you, and like the easiest way to do that is like look up the nearest major city to you and just type slackline and the nearest city that you live by, and I'm sure you'll find an existing group that is active in your area. And you don't even have to like invest into any of the gear at first. You could just like throw out a message on there and like they'll invite you to a meetup and you can try it. It's sick. You'll never go back.
Also, you mentioned GGBY. That is such an awesome festival. Can you like explain a little bit about what that is and how you can be involved, or, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. GGBY is actually a great place for beginners to come. It's essentially the biggest highline festival in the world. They rig something like 25 highlines over this area called the Fruit Bowl in Moab, Utah. And they also rig a giant space net usually. That's like really fun to just like come and hang out. They have a ton of beginner highlines, and there's usually like certified riggers. I was on the rigging team last year, and like it's all very organized and like legit, and it's not just a bunch of like people coming together like randomly. It's like a very organized event with lots of safety in mind, and very cool community gathering. And I highly recommend that anyone go to it if you have time. It's Thanksgiving week every year.
Gobble gobble, bitches, yeah.
Yep. GGBY.
Yeah, I have meant to go to it for a long time, but never made it. I will someday.
Maybe next year, because you just missed this one.
I know, but that was like kind of a renegade, right?
Yeah, this one was an unorganized version of it, but it'll come back.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. All right, dude. Super sick podcast.
Yeah, it's good talking to you, man.
Yeah. Love you so much. Like, thank you for taking the time to talk. And yeah, I'll see you as soon as I can.
Yeah, man. Hopefully soon. I haven't seen you since the large Dano rope swing, and I feel like that was in 2021. Yeah, it's been like it's been literally years.
Yeah, dude, let's climb sometime. I'm super psyched. I'm getting in like nose shape. I've like been whipping in the gym a bunch, so
heck yeah.
Yeah,
let's do it.
Yeah, dude, sick. Sweet podcast. Love you. Thank you for taking the time.
Love you too, man. Have a great rest of your night, and I'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Alonzo.
All right, see you, Jason.